Had my glares at the emissary been real or contrived? There's always more that can be taken. He was looking for something else I valued besides a rope around my waist. My hands trembled in my lap beneath the table. I squeezed them into fists and straightened them again, forcing them to comply, to be convincing. I pushed back my chair and stood next to Caden. I lifted my palm to his cheek, then drew his face to mine, kissing him long and passionately. His hands slid to my waist, pulling me closer. The room erupted into hoots and whistles. I slowly pulled away, looking into Caden's surprised eyes. "I've grown comfortable with the assassin after the long ride across the Camlanteau," I said to the Commissar. "I'll stay with him, rather than that treacherous parasite." I shot Rafe one last glare. He returned it with a glance of cool rage. But he was alive. For now, he was something not worth taking from me.
Chapter 10.
Caden's room was at the end of a long, dark hall. It had a small door with wide hinges frosted in rust and a lock in the shape of a boar's mouth. It didn't budge when he tried to push it open, as though the wood was swollen with the dampness, so he put his shoulder into it. It gave and swung open, banging into the wall. He held out his hand for me to go in first. I stepped in, hardly seeing the surroundings, only hearing the weighty thunk of the door closing behind us. I heard Caden step closer and felt the heat of his body close behind me. The taste of his mouth was still fresh on my lips. "This is it," he said simply, and I was grateful for the distraction. I looked around, finally taking in the expanse of the room. "It's bigger than I expected," I said. "A tower room," he answered, as if that explained it. But the room was large, and the outer wall curved, so maybe it did. I walked farther inside, stepping onto a black fur rug, my bare feet finally getting some relief from the cold floor. I wiggled my toes deep into the soft fleece, and then my eyes landed on a bed. A very small one shoved up against the wall. I noticed that everything, in fact, was shoved up against the wall in a dull, orderly procession, the way a soldier who only cared about practicality might arrange things. Next to the bed was a wooden barrel piled with folded blankets, a large trunk, a cold hearth, an empty fuel bin, a chest, and a water basin, followed by a line of mismatched trappings leaning against the wall side by side. A broom, wooden practice swords, three iron rods, a tall candlestick, and the very beleaguered boots he had worn across the Camlanteau, still caked with mud. Hanging overhead was a crude wooden chandelier, the oil in its lanterns aged to a deep tawny yellow. But then I saw details that didn't fit a soldier's quarters, their smallness suddenly larger than the room itself. Several books were stacked beneath his bed, more proof that he had lied about not reading. But it was the trinkets that made my throat swell. On the other side of the room, bits of blue and green colored glass strung on braided leather hung from a beam. Tucked in the corner was a chair, and lying in front of it was a chunky rug woven of colorful rags and uncarded wool. The gifts of the world, they come in many colors and strengths. Dihara's rug. And then, lying in a shallow basket on the floor, were ribbons, a dozen at least of every color, painted with suns and stars and crescent moons. I walked closer and lifted one, letting the purple silk trail through my palm. I blinked back the sting in my eyes.
"They always sent me off with something when I left," Caden explained.
"But not this last time. only a curse from sweet, gentle Natia, hoping that my horse would kick stones in his teeth. He would never be welcome in the vagabond camp again. Dread swept over me. Something loomed, even for the vagabonds. I had seen it in Dihara's eyes, and felt it in the tremble of her hand on my cheek when she said goodbye. Turn your ear to the wind. Stand strong. Did she hear something whisper through the valley? I sensed it now, something creeping through the floors and walls, reaching up through pillars. An ending. Or maybe I was feeling my own mortality drawing near. I heard Caden's footsteps behind me, and then felt his hands on my waist. They slowly circled around, pulling me to him. I drew in a sharp breath. His lips brushed my shoulder. Leah, finally we can... I closed my eyes. I couldn't do this. I stepped away and whirled to face him. He was smiling, his brows raised, a full, indulgent grin. He knew. Guilt and anger stabbed me at the same time. I spun and walked to the trunk, throwing it open. The closest thing to a nightgown I could find was one of his oversized shirts. I snatched it out and turned. "And I'll take the bed." I threw one of the folded blankets at him. He caught it, laughing. "Don't be angry with me, Leah. Remember, I know the difference between a real kiss from you and one given only for the Komazar's benefit." A real kiss. I couldn't deny what our first kiss had been. He dropped the blanket onto the rug. "Our kiss in the meadow set the bar high, though I admit I'll always treasure this contrived one, too." He reached up and touched the corner of his mouth, teasing, as if he was savoring the memory. I looked at him, his eyes still lit with mischief, and something tugged inside me. I saw someone who, for a moment, forgot that he was the assassin, the one who had dragged me here. "Why did you play along?" I asked. His smile faded. "It's been a long day. A hard day. I wanted to give you time. And maybe I hoped I wasn't just the lesser evil of your options." He was perceptive, but not perceptive enough. He pointed to the trunk. "If you dig a little deeper, you'll find some woolen socks, too." I dug to the bottom and found three pairs of long gray socks. He turned around for me, and I threw off the dress from hell that was lined with 1,000 burrs. His shirt was warm and soft and fell to my knees, and his socks came up just past them. "They look far better on you," he said when he turned around. He dragged the fur rug over near the bed and grabbed another blanket from the barrel, throwing it on the rug beside the other one. I used the wash basin in the corner while he prepared for bed, throwing off belts and boots, and lighting a candle. He told me that the door in the corner led to a chamber closet. It was a small room and far from luxurious, but compared to my last few nights camping amid hundreds of soldiers with barely a shred of privacy, it was perfection. It had hooks for towels, and even another of Dihara's braided rugs that offered welcome warmth from the bare floor. When I came out, he lowered the chandelier and extinguished the lanterns. The room flickered with the single golden candle, and I crawled into the narrow bed, staring at the ceiling above me, dancing with long shadows. The wind howled outside and pounded at the wood shutters. I pulled the quilt higher around my chin. "The emissary has a better chance of being alive at month's end than you do." I rolled over and curled into a ball. Caden lay on his back on the rug with his arms crossed behind his head, staring up at the ceiling. His shoulders were bare, the blanket only covering half of his chest. I could see the scars that he said didn't matter anymore, but refused to talk about. I scooted closer to the edge of the bed.
Tell me about the sanctum, Caden. Help me understand your world.
What do you want to know?
Everything. The governors, the brethren, the others who live here.
He rolled over to face me, lifting up on one elbow.
He told me the sanctum was the innermost part of the city, a protected fortress set aside for the council, who governed the kingdom of Venda. The council comprised the legion of governors from the 14 provinces of Venda, the 10 Ratan, who were the Komazar's elite guard, the 5 Chievdars, who oversaw the army, and the Komazar himself. 30 in all.
Are you part of the Ratan?
He nodded.
Me, Grizz, Malik, and 7 others.
What about Eben and Finch?
Eben's being groomed and will be Ratan one day. Finch is one of the first guard who aid the Ratan, but when he's not on duty, he lives outside of the sanctum with his wife.
And the other Ratan?
4 of them were there tonight. Jorik, Theron, Darius, and Gurton. The others are off meeting their assigned duties. Ratan means to never fail. That's what we're charged with. Never failing in our duty. And we never do.
Except for me. I was his failure, unless I did prove to be of value to Venda, and it seemed that would be determined only by the Komazar.
But does the Council really have any power? I asked. Doesn't the Komazar ultimately decide everything?
He rolled to his back, his hands lacing behind his head again.
Think of your own father's cabinet. They advise him, present options, but doesn't he have final say?
I thought about it, but I wasn't so sure. I had eavesdropped on cabinet meetings, boring affairs where decisions seemed already to be arrived at, cabinet members spewing off figures and facts in rote fashion. Rarely did a speech end in a question for my father to answer, and if he raised a question himself, the vice-regent, chancellor, or some other cabinet member would step in and say they'd investigate further, and the meeting would move on.
Does the Komazar have a wife? An heir?
He grunted.
No wife, and if he has any children, they don't carry his name. In Venda, power passes through spilled blood, not the inherited kind.
What the Komazar had told me was true. It was so foreign to the ways of Morrigan, and all the other kingdoms, too.
That makes no sense, I said. You mean the position of Komazar is open to anyone who kills him? What's to stop someone on the council from killing him and seizing the power himself?
It's a dangerous position to hold. The minute you do, there's a target on your back. Unless others see you as more valuable alive than dead, your chance of surviving until your next meal is slim. Few are willing to take the chance.
It seems a brutal way to govern.
It is. But it also means if you choose to lead, you must work very hard for Venda. And the Komazar does. For years in Venda, there were bloodbaths. It takes a strong man to navigate that line and stay alive.
How does he manage it?
Better than past Komazars. That's all that matters.
He went on to tell me about the various provinces, some large, some small, each with its own unique features and people. The governorship was passed down in the same way, through challenges when reigning governors grew weak or lazy. Most of the governors he liked, a few he despised, and a few were among the weak and lazy who might not be long for this world. The governors were supposed to spend alternate months in their provinces and the city, though most preferred the sanctum to their own fortresses and extended their stays. If this bleak city was preferable to their homes, I could only wonder how much more dismal those places must be. I questioned him about the strange architecture I had seen so far. He said Venda was a city built on a fallen one, reusing the available resources of the ruins.
It was a great city once. We're only just learning how great. Some think it held all the knowledge of the ancients.
That was a rather lofty claim for such a wretched city.
What makes you think so? I asked.
He told me the ancients had vast and elaborate temples built far below ground, though he wasn't certain they had all always been below the surface, and that maybe they had been buried by the devastation. He said every now and then, part of the city would collapse, literally falling in on itself when buried ruins below gave way. Sometimes that led to discoveries. He told me more about the many wings of the sanctum and the paths that connected them. Sanctum Hall, the tower quarters, and other meeting chambers were part of the main building, and the council wing was connected by tunnels or elevated walkways.
But as large as the sanctum may seem, he said, it's only a small part of the city. The rest spreads for miles, and it continues to grow.
I remembered my first glimpse of it, rising up in the distance like a black, eyeless monster. Even then, I felt the dark desperation of its construction, as if there were no tomorrows.
"Is there any other way to get in besides the bridge we crossed?" I asked.
He paused, staring at the beams above him. He knew what I really wanted to learn, if there was any other way out.
"No," he finally answered quietly. "There's no other way until the river widens hundreds of miles south of us and the current calms. But there are creatures in those waters that few will risk encountering, even on a raft."
He rolled over and looked at me, lifting up one arm.
"Only the bridge, Leah."
A bridge that required at least 100 men to raise and lower.
Our gazes were fixed, and the unstated question, "How do I get out of here?" hovered between us. I finally moved on, asking more about the bridge's construction. It seemed a carefully wrought wonder, considering the hapless construction of the rest of the city. He said the new bridge was finished 2 years ago. Before that, there had only been a small and dangerous footbridge. Resources were limited in Venda, but the one thing they didn't lack was rock, and within rock were metals. They had learned ways of mixing them that made the metal stronger and impervious to the constant mist of the river. It was no small task, extracting metals from rock, and I was surprised that they seemed to be accomplished at it. I had noticed the strange glint in the bracelets that Calantha wore, like nothing I had ever seen before. A beautiful blue-black metal that shone bright against her pale wrists. The circles of metal jingled down her arms when she lifted the platter of bones, like bells ringing in the sacristan and terravin.
"Listen, the gods draw near."
For a people who discounted the blessings of the gods, the hush that had fallen when Calantha spoke had been startlingly devout.
"Caden," I whispered, "when we were at dinner and Calantha gave the blessing, you said it was an acknowledgement of sacrifice. What were the words? I understood a few, but some were new to me."
"You understand more than I thought you did. You surprised everyone when you spoke tonight."
"It shouldn't have been a surprise after my tirade this morning."
He grinned. "Speaking the choice words of Venden is not the same thing as commanding the language."
"But there are still words that are foreign to me. None of you ever said that blessing over a meal in all our way across the Camlanto."
"We've grown accustomed to living many different lives. Some of our ways we have to leave behind once we pass the borders of Venda."
"Tell me Calantha's prayer."
He sat up and faced me. The glow of the candle lit one side of his face. E Christav Unterkienat, he said reverently. A sacrifice ever remembered. Meunter Ijotande, never forgotten. Yavien Hal Anziadre, another day we live. The words bored into me, and all the ways I had misinterpreted the wearing of the bones. Food can be scarce in Venda, he explained, especially in winter. The bones are a symbol of gratitude, and a reminder that we live only by the sacrifice of even the smallest animal, and by the combined sacrifices of many. Meunter Ijotande. I was shamed at the beauty of every syllable of what I had once called barbarian grunts. It was a strange emotion to feel side by side with the bitterness of my captivity. There were so many times I had looked at Caden back in Taravan and wondered what storm was passing through his eyes. I knew what at least part of that storm was now. I'm sorry, I whispered. For what? For not understanding. Until you've lived here, how could you know? Venda is a different world. There was one more word. Everyone said it together at the end. Paviama. His expression changed, his eyes searching mine and warmth lighting them. It means... He shook his head. There's no direct translation in Morighese for paviama. It's a word of tenderness, and has many meanings, depending on how it's used. Even the tone in which it's said can change its meaning. Pavia, paviamas, paviamad, paviamande. Friendship, thankfulness, care, mercy, forgiveness, love. It's a beautiful word, I whispered. Yes, he agreed. I watched his chest rise in a deep breath. He hesitated, as if he wanted to say more, but then he lay back down and looked up at the rafters. We should get some sleep. The Komazar expects to see us early in the morning. Was there anything else you wanted to know? The Komazar expects. The warmth that had filled the room was swept away with a single sentence, and I pulled the quilt closer. No, I whispered. He reached out and snuffed the candle with his fingers. But there was still a question stabbing me that I was afraid to ask. Would the Komazar really send Rafe home piece by piece? Deep down, I knew the answer. Vendans had cut a whole company of men to pieces, my own brother among them. A massacre, and the Komazar had praised them for it. You did well, Chievdar. What was one more emissary to him? All I could do was make sure he didn't perceive him as something valuable to take from me. I turned toward the wall, unable to sleep, listening to Caden's breathing and his restless turning. I wondered about his regret at the choices he had made, and all the throats he hadn't held back from slitting. How much easier his life would be now if he had slit mine as he was ordered to do. The wind picked up, whistling through crevices, and I nestled deeper under the blankets, wondering about my own regrets to come, for the things I was yet to do. The room closed in, dark and black and far from everything I had ever known. I felt like a child again, wishing I could curl into my mother's arms on a stormy night and she could whisper away my fears. The wind punched and thrashed against the shutters, unforgiving, and I felt something wet trickle down the side of my face. I reached up and swiped the salty wetness away. How quaint. How very quaint. Like believing some things last forever.
a tear. As if that could make a difference.
Chapter 11. Caden.
Enjoy your pet for now. Every aspect of the words ate at me. Enjoy. Seeing Leah's fear made it impossible to enjoy anything. Seeing her paraded through the hall in a sack made me sick in a way I hadn't been since I was a child. Why hadn't I thought it out? Was I as thick as Malik? Of course, the Komazar couldn't treat her as an honored guest. I hadn't expected that. But seeing her grasping at fabric to cover herself... I slammed a cupboard shut and rummaged through another in the larder under the scrutinizing eye of the cook. She didn't approve of me raiding her kitchen. "Here!" she snapped, slapping away my hand when I reached for a wheel of cheese. "I'll do it!" She grabbed a knife to cut off a chunk for me. I watched her move about the kitchen, gathering more food. Your pet. I knew how the Komazar perceived royals. I couldn't blame him. It was how I had perceived them, too. But she wasn't selfish fluff wearing a crown. When she had defied all of us and killed Eben's horse, that wasn't fluff. For now. Temporary, fleeting, provisional. But bringing Leah to Venda was a forever move for me. An ending and a beginning. Or maybe it was a return to some part of me I didn't want to die. Don't do it. The words had beat through me back in Terevin as I had watched her walk alone through the woods. They had tapped in my skull again as I had sat in the barn loft, drawing my knife across my whetstone. I had never defied an order before. But I hadn't disregarded his command just because I fell for the charms of a girl. Leah was hardly charming, at least not in the usual way. There was something else that drew me to her. I'd thought just getting her here would be enough, and that once she was here, there'd be no reason to kill her. She'd be safe. She could be forgotten, and the Komazar could move on to his other plans. I'll decide the best way to use her. But now she could become part of those plans. Leah's words on the battlefield had echoed through my head since the day she said them, forevermore. And for the first time, I was starting to understand how long that was. I was only 19, and it seemed I had lived 2 lifetimes already. Now I was beginning a third, a life where I had to learn new rules, living in Venda and keeping Leah alive. If I had just done my job as I always had before, I wouldn't have to worry about any of this. Leah would be another forgotten notch on my belt. But now she was something else, something that didn't fit into any of the rules of Venda.
She asks for another story, one to pass the time and fill her. I search for the truth, the details of a world so long past now, I'm not sure it ever was. Once upon a time, so very long ago, in an age before monsters and demons roamed the earth, a time when children ran free in meadows, and heavy fruit hung from trees. There were cities, large and beautiful, with sparkling towers that touched the sky. Were they made of magic? I was only a child myself. I thought they could hold a whole world. To me they were made of... Yes, they were spun of magic and light and the dreams of gods. And there was a princess? I smile. Yes, my child. A precious princess just like you. She had a garden filled with trees that hung with fruit as big as a man's fist. The child looks at me doubtful. She has never seen an apple, but she has seen the fists of men. Are there really such gardens, Amma? Not anymore. Yes, my child. Somewhere. And one day you will find them. The Last Testaments of Gudrell. Chapter 12.
I startled awake, gasping for air, and looked around, taking in the stone walls, the wooden floor, the heavy quilt still covering me, and the man's shirt I wore for a nightgown. It wasn't a dream. I really was here. I glanced at the rug on the floor next to me, empty, the blankets from last night neatly folded and returned to the top of the barrel. Caden was gone. There had been a storm last night, winds like I had never heard before, loose bits of the city battering against walls. I thought I would never sleep, but then when I did, I must have slept hard, drawn into dreams of endless rides across a savanna, lost in grass waving far over my head, and stumbling upon Pauline on her knees praying for me. Then I was back in Terravin again, Bertie bringing me bowls of warm broth, rubbing my forehead, whispering, "Look at the trouble you get into." But then her face transformed into my mother's, and she drew closer, her breath searing hot on my cheek. "You're a soldier now, Leah, a soldier in your father's army." I thought I had sat up awake, but then beautiful, sweet Greta, a golden crown of braid circling about her head, walked toward me. Her eyes were blank, sightless, and blood dripped from her nose. She was trying to mouth Walther, but no sound would come out because an arrow pierced her throat. But it was the last dream that actually woke me. It was hardly a dream at all, only a flash of color, a hint of movement, a sense I couldn't quite grasp. There was a cold, wide sky, a horse, and Rafe. I saw the side of his face, a cheekbone, his hair blowing in the wind. But I knew he was leaving. Rafe was going home. It should have been a comfort, but instead it felt like a terrible loss. I wasn't with him. He was leaving without me. I lay there, gasping, wondering if it was only the Komazar's prediction haunting me. The emissary has a better chance of being alive at month's end than you do. I threw back the quilt and jumped out of bed, inhaling deeply, trying to lift the weight on my chest. I looked around the room. I hadn't heard Caden leave, but neither had I heard him the night he came to kill me in my cottage while I slept. Silence was his strength, while it was my weakness. I crossed the room to the door and tried it, but it was locked. I went to the window and pushed open the shutter. A blast of cold air hit me, and goosebumps shivered up my arms. A glistening, dripping city was laid out before me, a raw, smoky pinkness to it in the pre-dawn light. This was Venda. The monster was just waking, the soft underbelly beginning to rumble and stir. A horse hitched to a dray and led by a cloaked figure ambled down a narrow street below me. Far across the way, a woman swept a walk, water spraying out to the ground below. Dark, huddled figures stirred in shadows. The dim light bled onto the edges of parapets, dipped in crenellations, spilled across scaled walls and rutted muddy lanes, a reluctance to its slow crawl. I heard a soft tap and turned. It was so faint I wasn't sure where it came from. The door, or somewhere outside below me? Another soft tap. And then I heard the scrape of a key in the lock. The door eased open a few inches, the rusty hinges whining. Another soft tap. I grabbed one of the wooden practice swords leaning against the wall and raised it, ready to strike if necessary. "Come in," I called. The door swung open. It was one of the boys I had seen last night pushing the carts into Sanctum Hall. His blonde hair was chopped off in uneven chunks close to his head, and his large brown eyes grew wider when he saw the wooden sword in my hand.
"Miss, I only brought your boots."
He gingerly held them up as if he was afraid to startle me. I lowered the sword. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to..."
"You don't have to explain, miss. It's good to be prepared. I could have been one of those monster men coming through the door."
He giggled.
"But that little sword couldn't knock their arse an inch."
I smiled. "No, I suppose not. You're one of the boys from last night, aren't you? The ones who brought in the carts." He looked down, and red seeped across his cheeks.
"I'm not a boy, miss. I'm a..."
I caught my breath, realizing my mistake. "A girl, of course," I said, trying to find a way to take away her embarrassment. "I just woke up. I haven't quite brushed the sleep from my eyes yet." She reached up and rubbed her short, uneven hair.
"Nah, it's the buggy hair. You can't work in the sanctum if you've got vermin, and I ain't much good with a knife."
She was willow thin, certainly not more than 12, with no bloom of womanhood yet. Her shirt and trousers were the same drab brown as the rest of the boys.
"But one day, I'm going to grow it real long like yours, all pretty and braided-like."
She shifted from foot to foot, rubbing her skinny arms. "What's your name?" I asked.
"Aster."
"Aster," I repeated. The same name as the powerful angel of destruction. But she looked more like a forlorn angel with badly clipped wings. I listened to her distorted assessment of the angel Aster, clearly not what the Moragee's holy text revealed.
"My papa says Mama named me for an angel right before she drew her last breath. He said she smiled all full of the last glow, then called me Aster. That's the angel who showed Venda the way through the gates to the city. The saving angel, she's called. That's what..."
She suddenly straightened, clamping her lips to a firm line.
"I was warned not to prattle. I'm sorry, miss. Here are your boots."
She stepped forward formally, set them down in front of me, then took a stiff step back again. "Where I'm from," Aster, "sharing a few words isn't prattle. It's the polite and friendly thing to do. I hope you'll come and prattle with me every day." She grinned and skimmed her head again self-consciously. I looked at my boots, cleaned and neatly laced. "How did you come by them?" I asked. I was pleased to learn that silence was not Aster's strength either. We had something in common. She told me she got them from Eben. He grabbed them just before they were being sent off to market. My clothes were already gone, but he snuck the boots out of the pile and cleaned them for me. He'd be whipped if anyone found out. But Eben was good at being sly, and she promised I didn't need to worry.
"As far as those boots are concerned, they got up and walked off by themselves."
"Will you be whipped for bringing them to me?" I asked. She looked down, the pink tinging her cheeks again.
"I'm not that brave, miss. Sorry. I brought them on orders from the assassin."
I knelt so I was eye to eye with her. "If you insist I call you Aster, then I insist you call me Leah. That's short for Jezaleah. Can you do that, Aster?" She nodded. And then, for the first time, I noticed the ring on her thumb, so loose she had to hold her hand in a fist to keep from losing it. It was the ring of a Morrigese pageantry guard. She had taken a ring from the carts. She saw me staring at it, and her mouth fell open.
"It was my pick," she explained. "I won't keep it. I'll sell it at market, but just for overnight I wanted to feel its goldness all smooth on my skin. I rubbed that red stone all night, making wishes."
"What do you mean, Aster, your pick?"
"The Commissar always gives the barrel runners first pick of the booty."
"The governor's pick after you?" She nodded.
"The whole council goes after us. The Commissar makes sure of that. My papa will be happy for my pick. The quarter lords, they love rings. This might fetch us a whole sack of grain, and papa can stretch a sack for a month."
I listened to the way she talked of the Commissar, more like a benefactor than a tyrant.
"You said always. Are there many carts brought into the sanctum?"
"No," she said. "Used to be just goods from the trading caravans every few months, but now there's war bounty. We've had 6 loads this month, but this was the biggest one. The others were only 3 or 4 barrelfuls."
War bounty. The patrols were being slaughtered. Small companies of men were riding to their deaths with no idea that the game had changed. They weren't chasing a few barbarians back behind borders any longer. They were being stalked by organized brigades. For what? Rings to give to servants? No, there was something else to it. Something important enough to send an assassin to kill me.
"Did I say something wrong, Miz?"
I looked back at Aster, still feeling dazed. She bit her lip, intent on my answer. A sudden voice startled us.
"The door's wide open. How long does it take to drop off 1 pair of boots?"
Neither of us had heard Caden approaching. He stood in the doorway, looking sternly at Aster.
"Not long," she gasped. "I just got here. Truly I did. I wasn't prattling."
She squeezed past him, worried as a mouse with a cat on her tail, and we heard the echo of her footsteps running down the hall. Caden smiled.
"You frightened her. Did you have to be so stern?" I asked.
His eyebrows rose, and he looked down at my hand.
"I'm not the one holding a sword."
He closed the door behind him and walked across the room, setting a flask and basket down on one of the trunks.
"I brought you some food so you don't have to dine in the hall. Eat and get dressed, and we'll go. The Commissar's expecting us."
"Get dressed? In what?"
He looked at the sack dress balled up on the floor. "No," I said. "I'll wear the shirt I have on and a pair of your trousers."
"I'll talk to him, Leah, I promise. But for now, just do what I..."
"He said I had to earn luxuries like clothes, but he didn't say how."
"I'll fight you for them."
I waved the sword in circles at the floor, taunting him. He shook his head.
"No, Leah, that isn't a toy. You'd only end up getting hurt. Put it away."
He spoke to me like I was Aster, a child who had no understanding of consequences. No, worse, like a royal who hadn't a grasp of anything. His tone was superior and dismissive and more Venden than ever. Heat bristled at my temples.
"I've swung a stick before," I said. "What else is there to know?"
I pursed my lips and looked at the sword with wide-eyed wonderment.
"And this is the hilt, right?" I asked, touching the crosswood. "I played with these with my brothers when I was a child."
I looked back at him, my jaw set.
"Afraid?"
He grinned.
"I warned you."
He reached for the other sword leaning against the wall, and I lunged, whacking his shin.
"What are you doing?"
he yelled, grimacing. He hopped on one leg while he clutched the injured one. We haven't started yet.
Yes, we have. You started this months ago, I said, and swung again, hitting the same leg from the side. He seized the other sword and held it out to defend himself, hobbling in obvious pain.
You can't just let me explain something to you, Caden, I said, circling around him.
He limped around, trying to keep me in sight.
If this were a real sword, you'd already be bleeding out. You'd be faint, if you could stand at all, because my second strike would have cut your calf muscles and tendons and opened vital veins. All I'd have to do is keep you moving, and your heart would do the rest, pumping your blood out until you collapsed, which would be right about now.
He winced, holding his shin and at the same time keeping his sword ready to block other lunges.
Damn it, Leah! You see, Caden, maybe I lied. Maybe I wasn't just a child when I used one of these last, and maybe it wasn't play. Maybe my brothers taught me to fight dirty, to gain the advantage. Maybe they taught me to understand my weaknesses and strengths. I know I may not have the reach or the sheer power of someone like you, but I can easily beat you in other ways. And it seems I already have.
Not yet. He lunged forward, advancing with rapid strikes that I managed to block until he backed me up against the wall. He grabbed my arm that held the sword and pinned it, then leaned against me, short of breath.
And now I have the advantage.
He looked down at me, his breaths coming slower and deeper.
No, I said. You've bled out by now. You're already dead.
His eyes grazed my face, my lips, his breath hot on my cheek.
Not quite, he whispered.
Do I wear your shirt and trousers or not? A hissing breath escaped between his teeth. He released my arm and hobbled to the chair in the corner.
I didn't hit you that hard, I said.
No? He sat down and pulled up his pant leg. Just above his boot, an egg-sized knot was already swelling. I knelt and looked at it. It was nasty. I had struck harder than I thought.
Caden,
I shook my head and looked up at him, searching for words to explain. He sighed.
Your point is made.
I still wasn't sure that he understood why I was angered or why I attacked him. It wasn't just about clothes.
Caden, I'm trapped in a city with thousands of people who hate everything about who I am. The Komazar demeaned me in front of your entire council last night. The one thing I can't bear is that same derision from you. Haven't you learned anything about me yet? Yes, royals know how to do things beyond counting our 12 toes. You're all I have here. You're my only ally.
His eyes narrowed at the word ally.
What about Wraith?
What about him? He's a conniving accomplice to a prince who'd probably like to see me dead more than anyone. A prince who's betraying my kingdom by proposing deals to yours, and Wraith is brokering the deal for his own benefit. Whatever I thought may have passed between us is exactly that. Past. He was an unfortunate distraction for me, too, and certainly not an ally. He's nothing to me but an ugly wart on my good judgment.
He studied my face and finally grinned. And your judgment had a decidedly sharp aim.
I looked back at his growing knot. Is there an ice house in the sanctum?
He snorted. This isn't Bertie's tavern, Leah.
He limped over to the trunk and rummaged through it, pulling out some trousers and a wide leather belt.
These should do for now, he said, and he threw them on the bed.
As a precaution, I gathered up the sack dress from the floor, opened the shuttered window, and threw it out.
Jabavay, I grumbled after it.
I brushed my hands with finality and turned back to him. At least one matter was settled.
I would never again be wearing the dress of thorns. I peeked in the basket he had brought. "What's so important that the Komazar has to see us this early?" I asked as I began eating the hard rolls and cheese. The memory of public executions in Morrigan surfaced. They had always taken place just after dawn. What if the Komazar hadn't believed Rafe's story after all?
"He's leaving to check on Balwood Province in the north. The governor didn't show, which likely means he's dead," Caden answered. "But the Komazar has some matters here to settle before he goes."
Leaving. The word was like music. The best news I'd heard in months. Though I did worry what the matters were that needed settling. I finished eating, and Caden stepped outside while I finished dressing. I noticed again the splintering cry of the hinges when he opened the door, and wondered how I had slept through the noise when he left earlier. It felt good to put my boots on again, clean, with clean socks to wear, too. I would bless Eben for this tonight when I sang my remembrances. I said them every night now, almost as if I was saying them in Pauline's stead, as if she were here with me, and we were on our way to Terravin, about to begin a great adventure, instead of me being here alone at the end of this one. We walked to the Council Wing Square. Again, we passed through a maze of hallways, open courtyards, and narrow, windowless paths with one lantern barely lighting the way to the next. Caden told me the sanctum was riddled with abandoned and forgotten passageways after centuries of being built and rebuilt, some with dead ends and deadly drops, so I should stay close. Many of the walls told stories of their ruin. The stacked rubble sometimes offered up the macabre, like a sculptured arm or a partially visible head of stone blankly staring out from the wall like an ageless prisoner, or a piece of engraved marble block with a note from another time, the letters dripping away like tears. But they were only stone, the same as any other, repurposed to build up the city, an available resource, as Caden called them. Still, as we entered another dim passageway, I sensed something else and stopped, pretending to adjust the lace of my boot. I pressed my back against the wall. A beat. A warning. A whisper. Was I simply spooked by a ghoulish hallway? "Jezalia, you're here." I stood abruptly, almost losing my balance.
"Coming?" Caden asked.
The thrum disappeared, but the air was cold in its wake. I looked around. Only the scuffle of our movement filled the passage. Yes, spooked, that was all. Caden moved forward through the passage again, and I followed him. He was in his element, that was certain, as comfortable walking through this strange city as I was disoriented. How foreign Terravin must have been to him. And yet it wasn't. He had easily fit in. His Morrigese was flawless, and he had sat back in the tavern ordering an ale like it was a second home to him. Was that why he thought I could just slip into this life as if my old one never existed? I wasn't a chameleon like Caden, who could become a new person just by crossing a border. We walked up a winding flight of stairs and emerged in a square similar to the one we'd arrived in yesterday. But of course it wasn't square. Nothing in Venda was. On the far side, I could see stables with horses being led in and out by soldiers. Loose chickens scratched and strutted, feathers ruffling as they skipped to avoid the horses. Two spotted hogs rooted in a pen near us, and ravens twice the size of any in Morrigan squawked from their perch high on a tower overlooking the square. I spotted the Komazar in the distance, directing some wagons that were rolling through gates as if he were a sentry. For the leader of a kingdom, he seemed to have his hands in everything. I didn't see Rafe, which brought me some uneasy relief. At least he wasn't here with a rope around his neck. But that didn't mean he was safe. Where had they put him? All I knew was that he was somewhere near the Komazar's quarters in a secure room. It might be no more than a barbaric cell. As we approached, the guards, governors, and Ratan saw the Komazar stop and turn toward us. They turned too. I felt the weight of the Komazar's scrutiny. His eyes rolled over me and my new attire. When we stopped at the edge of the crowd, he strolled over to give me a more critical inspection.
"Maybe I didn't make myself clear last night. Certain luxuries, like clothing and shoes, have to be earned."
"She earned them," Caden said,
nearly cutting off the Komazar's words. There was a drawn-out, hushed moment, and then the Komazar threw his head back and laughed. The others did, too, boisterous guffaws, one governor punching Caden in the shoulder. My cheeks burned. I wanted to kick Caden's other shin, but his explanation kept the boots on my feet. Just like soldiers in a tavern, the governors enjoyed their coarse entertainment.
"Surprising," the Komazar said under his breath, shooting me a questioning glance. "Maybe royals do have some use after all."
Kalantha approached, followed by four soldiers leading horses. I recognized the Morrigese Ravians. More booty from the massacre.
"These are the ones?" the Komazar asked.
"The worst of the lot," Kalantha answered. "Alive but injured. Their wounds are festering."
"Take them to the Veldt Quarterlord for butchering," he ordered. "Make sure he distributes the meat fairly. And make sure they know it's a gift from the Sanctum."
I saw that the horses were hurt, but the injuries were gashes that could be cleaned and dressed by a surgeon, not mortal wounds. He dismissed her and walked over to the wagons, waving for the council to follow him. But I saw Kalantha's lone, pale eye linger on him, the hesitation as she turned away herself. Longing? For him? I looked at the Komazar. As Gwyneth would say, he was easy enough on the eyes, and there was something undeniably magnetic about his presence. He exuded power. His manner was calculating and demanded awe. But longing? No. Perhaps it was something else I saw in her glance. The drivers of the wagons were busy loosening tarps, and the Komazar spoke with a man carrying a ledger. He was a thin, scruffy fellow, and seemed oddly familiar. He spoke softly with the Komazar, keeping his whispers away from the governor's ears. I stepped behind the others, peeking through the backs of the Sanctum Brethren, studying him. "What is it?" Caden whispered.
"Nothing," I answered.
And it probably was. The drivers threw the tarps back, and a sickening thud hit my chest. Crates. Before the Komazar even pried one open, I knew what was inside. He pushed aside straw, pulling bottles from it and handing them out to the governors. He walked over to Caden.
"And I can't forget the assassin, can I? Enjoy, my brother."
He turned to look at me.
"Why so pale, princess? You don't enjoy the vintage of your own vineyards? I can assure you, the governors love it."
It was the revered Cangiovese of the Morrigese vineyards.
Apparently raiding trading caravans was among the Komazar's many talents. This was how he secured his position, procuring luxuries for his council that only he seemed able to obtain, bottles of expensive wine for his governors that the lesser kingdoms paid great sums for, gifts of war booty for servants, fresh meat donated to the hungry. But a full stomach was a full stomach. How could I argue with that? And my own father gave gifts to his cabinet, though he didn't raid caravans to get them. how many Morrigy's drivers had died at the hands of raiders so the Komazar could indulge his governors. What else did they steal? And who did they kill to get it? The death list seemed to grow and grow. He gave the count